Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Leslie Kernison, board-certified geriatrician and the founder of the website betterhealthwhileaging.net. And this is the Better Health While Aging video podcast, where we discuss common health problems that affect people over age 60 and the best ways to prevent and manage those problems. We also often address common concerns and dilemmas that come up with aging parents and other older loved ones, like what to do if you're worried about falls or safety or memory or even the quality of an older person's healthcare. In today's episode, I am going to talk about the treatment of Alzheimer's and related dementias. And specifically, I want to talk about four oral medications that have been FDA approved for quite a while to treat Alzheimer's. And I want to talk about these because these are very, very commonly prescribed to people who are experiencing memory problems or thinking problems. And these are all older, pretty well-established drugs. They were first approved between 1996 and 2003. So at this point, they have a pretty well-established track record, and we have a lot of experience using them. Now, I want to talk about this in part because in recent years, there's been a lot of interest and excitement in a type of newer Alzheimer's treatment that first became available just a few years ago. These are anti-amyloid drugs that require infusions. And today, in the fall of 2024, we have two drugs available, lecanemab, brand name Leqembi, and donanemab, brand name Kisunla. Now, I'm not going to go in depth into these in this episode because I do have another video featuring a guest expert where we talk in depth about those medications. But if you are interested in Alzheimer's treatment, I think it's really good to understand the basics of the older medications that are still the most commonly prescribed ones. And then, of course, I would encourage you to learn more about newer medications and the new frontier of treatment as well. So in this video, again, we're going to talk about these older medications. And I'm going to talk about what I think older adults and families should know about cholinesterase inhibitors. And those are the most commonly prescribed ones. They include donepezil, brand name Aricept, rivastigmine, brand name Exelon, and galantamine, brand name Razadine. And then I'm going to talk about what to know about memantine. The brand name there is Namenda. I'm going to talk about how well do we think these drugs work for treating Alzheimer's and dementia. I'm going to talk about whether they work for other types of dementia, because of course, Alzheimer's is not the only type of dementia out there. It is the most common underlying cause of dementia, but there are other conditions that also cause dementia. I'm going to talk about what to know if you are considering stopping these medications, or if you've been on these medications, or if you're thinking about stopping these medications. And I'm also going to talk about some other things to know when it comes to treating and managing Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. So cholinesterase inhibitors, this means medications such as donepezil, brand name Aricept. What are they? So these are medications that relate to an important neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. It's a neurotransmitter that is involved in the brain's thinking processes, and levels are lower in Alzheimer's disease. So cholinesterase inhibitors help boost levels of acetylcholine in the brain. Now, acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter that also plays important roles elsewhere in the body throughout the parasympathetic nervous system. So medications that affect acetylcholine might not only affect the brain, but can also affect other parts of the body. And there are three cholinesterase inhibitors that are FDA approved to treat Alzheimer's in mild to moderate stages. Again, they are donepezil, rivastigmine, and galantamine. Now, if you're wondering which one to take, I can tell you that the efficacy and side effects are comparable among all three of them. Some of them can be easier for some people to tolerate than others. Rivastigmine for a long time came as a patch. So sometimes choosing them is a little bit about what's on your formulary and which particular side effects have come up for you, and switching perhaps to try to find something that causes fewer side effects. You should also know that donepezil and rivastigmine also have FDA approval to treat more severe dementia, but there's really no reason to believe that galantamine is going to be significantly different. It's partly a question of whether the drug companies did the trials to specify to the FDA and confirm that there was proof that they worked for a certain stage of dementia. Now, since I mentioned mild to moderate dementia or severe dementia, what are we talking about? So when people develop dementia, and by this it means chronic problems with memory or thinking that are bad enough to affect independence in daily life activities and that we don't think is due to some other kind of shorter-term medical problem, This is a condition where the brain is changing and generally declining slowly over years and years and years and years. And it's important to know that some medications might work for an earlier stage of dementia, but not really for a later stage of dementia. So when research is done on dementia and on medications or other treatments for dementia, they generally will specify a stage of dementia that they are focusing on. We certainly need to know who was being studied. And so in trials, dementia severity has historically often been categorized with something called the mini mental state exam, or sometimes with the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, the MoCA. So mild dementia is often, and it can vary a little bit depending on the study, but it's often about a mini mental 19 to 26 or a MoCA 12 to 16. Moderate might be a mini mental 10 to 18, a MoCA 4 to 11, and severe might be a mini mental less than 10 and a MoCA less than 4. So coming back to cholinesterase inhibitors, what exactly are they doing? What is the effect that we can notice? Well, in studies, what they have found is that the effect is generally what's called a modest symptomatic improvement in cognition and in global functioning. This can feel pretty small and subtle sometimes to people. In some people, they seem visibly brighter and sharper. Their family feels they're visibly brighter and sharper. But in other people, it seems to be pretty small. It's important to know that these drugs do not reverse Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's disease in particular is due to a type of neurodegeneration of brain cells slowly sickening and eventually dying. And this process generally starts at least 15 years before symptoms are obvious. And there are other types of dementia, such as Lewy body dementia, that are also related to neurodegeneration. And if you'd like to know more about types of dementia, I do have a video that covers these in depth. So cholinesterase inhibitors do boost levels of acetylcholine in the brain, but this doesn't reverse that process of the neurons being affected and getting sick and dying. That process is often related to levels of amyloid beta and or beta amyloid, I think they usually say, and tau. And these drugs are not doing anything to stop that. So they're not protecting neurons. They're not changing the underlying disease. And people do continue to get worse over time on these medications. However, these medications might help people's brain work a little bit better for the level of damage that has happened and is happening. And in terms of side effects, again, because acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter used throughout the body, people do often experience side effects because the medication can increase acetylcholine in other parts of the body. So this can cause stomach upsets, nausea, and diarrhea. Your parasympathetic nervous system is generally in charge of the rest and digest part of the body. So digestion is very much affected. People often adapt to this side effect with some time, but for some people, it's really persistent. And again, using the patch means that the medication isn't being orally taken and can reduce some of those gastrointestinal side effects. Some people will also get sleep disturbances, very vivid dreams, or start sleeping badly. That has been seen especially with donepezil, brand name Aricept. And then any of them can slow the heart rate. Your parasympathetic system is the one that relaxes you, that kind of calms you down. A little too much of that can make the heart rate too slow, especially in older adults who already have some abnormalities in how well their hearts conduct the heartbeat and in maintaining a steady, fast enough heartbeat. So for people who are known to have those kinds of heart conditions, these may not be good medications to take. And occasionally somebody who is on this type of medication does experience a slow heart rate. And to speak a little bit more to the efficacy, the average benefit overall seems to be a small improvement in thinking abilities and in ability to manage activities of daily living. It's been compared to a few months of delay in progression of symptoms. And it has been studied, but it's not really clear that this affects long-term outcomes that sometimes we really care about. Like, will the person eventually need to go in a nursing home or need a lot of support at home? So the truth is that especially when the scientific evidence is reviewed by people who do not have a financial stake in the medication, sometimes it's concluded that the effect seems to be clinically marginal. That said, it also seems that there's a really variable effect in different individuals. So it's been posited that, you know, up to 30 to 50% of people are not experiencing any benefit, but up to 20% might show more response than usual. And this might depend on genetics, but also reflects the fact that what we often diagnose as Alzheimer's or as dementia, or as different types of dementia, is often a can be a very variable process in the brain. So it might be that how well people respond to this medication depends a bit on the specific types of ways that their brain is being affected by the disease or diseases, because we know that especially once people get into their 80s, they tend to have more than one cause of damage to the brain. It could be Alzheimer's combined with vascular disease, for instance, or Alzheimer's combined with Lewy body, or we're discovering even other types of dementias that can affect older adults. So we know that it's very common when people reach their 80s and older to have a mix of those. And that may also affect how well they respond to these medications. Now, something else to know about these medications is that in a way, their effect to boost levels of acetylcholine is the opposite of the effect that many other medications have. Many other medications are, and this usually is not the intention of the medication, but they are anticholinergic. They actually block acetylcholine. And those tend to make people a bit sleepy and drowsy and constipated and dry mouth. And lots of commonly used medications are like this, including, for instance, Benadryl, over-counter medications, and also many prescription medications. So if you are somebody who is considering taking a cholinesterase inhibitor because you have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia, you want to be careful and make sure you're not also on one of these anticholinergic medications, because then you're kind of on two medications that are having an opposite effect. So if you want to learn more about those really commonly used anticholinergic medications, they might be bad for memory. Certainly, if you have Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, they can affect your ability to think the best you can. Please check out my video on that topic as well. Let's now talk about memantine, brand name Namenda. So this is a totally different type of medication. It has a very different mechanism of action. And when it received its FDA approval, they had difficulty showing that it had much effect in people who had mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease, but it did show an effect in moderate to severe Alzheimer's disease. And so that is what it is technically FDA approved to treat. And this is a, you know, technically an N-methyl-D-aspartate receptor antagonist. And really, the effect that it has is to dampen the excitatory effect of a different neurotransmitter, which is called glutamate in the brain, because it seems that, you know, a little excitation of neurons can be a good thing, but too much can actually make them sort of overly stressed and exhausted. And then they don't work as well. Possibly it can also accelerate damage to them. That has been hypothesized. So memantine is thought to have an effect in part by protecting neurons and keeping them from getting, you know, toxically overexcited. The effects, again, are generally going to seem modest. In studies, it was a small improvement in cognition. Many people don't notice much. Some people seem to have more of a response to it. And the side effects generally are going to be sometimes some dizziness, sometimes some drowsiness, sometimes some headache. Now, in some people with dementia, it seems to increase agitation and hallucinations, especially if they seem to otherwise have dementia with Lewy body or another form that, you know, is prone to hallucinations. But mostly this medication is well tolerated. And you should know that it is quite common for it to be combined with a cholinesterase inhibitor. Now, you might remember that I said there are three cholinesterase inhibitors. So basically three medications currently in use that are all in the same class. So donepezil, brand name Aricept, rivastigmine, brand name Exelon, and galantamine, brand name Razadyne. It would be extremely unusual to be taking more than one cholinesterase at the same time. We generally don't do that in medicine. However, it is very common to combine one cholinesterase inhibitor with also Namenda, especially when people are getting further along in their dementia journey. But sometimes some neurologists or prescribers might prescribe both fairly early on. I certainly see that happening. Now, you may be thinking, what about the stage that precedes dementia, the stage that is called mild cognitive impairment, sometimes also called minor neurocognitive disorder? Now, if you want to learn about more about mild cognitive impairment and dementia and how it relates to Alzheimer's, I have a video about that. But really briefly, mild cognitive impairment does not always lead to Alzheimer's or another type of dementia. But in some people, it does, because it is an intermediate stage of cognition between having totally normal memory and thinking and having your memory or thinking processes be impaired enough that you can no longer manage daily life activities independently. So in mild cognitive impairment, people are having a little difficulty. They're less efficient. They might have to work harder, but generally they can still get whatever it is they're trying to do done. And it is an intermediate stage. No, there are some people who have mild cognitive impairment and it's not the earliest stage of dementia, but or something that will turn into dementia, I should say. But sometimes it is the earliest stage of something that is going to turn into dementia. So you may be wondering, do these medications work for mild cognitive impairment? And the answer is probably not. This was studied quite a lot by the drug companies. And in studies, cholinesterase inhibitors failed to prevent the progression of mild cognitive impairment to dementia. So there is really not any great evidence to treat mild cognitive impairment with cholinesterase inhibitors, much less memantine, which didn't even really show much effect in people with mild to moderate dementia. That said, it remains quite common for these drugs to be prescribed for mild cognitive impairment. Now, until recently, the American Academy of Neurology had a practice parameter about mild cognitive impairment, and their recommendation was that if clinicians chose to prescribe a cholinesterase inhibitor or another medication for mild cognitive impairment, they should clarify that the evidence doesn't particularly support this, but you know, if people want to try and see if it seems to help them in particular, they could potentially do that. So that used to be their recommendation. That guideline is now being revised and I think is no longer available, but that was the guideline that they had. I think they've had first published in 2018 and reaffirmed it in 2021. I think they're rethinking it right now in light of the developments otherwise in Alzheimer's treatment. Now, what about other types of dementia? So again, dementia, the condition of having memory or thinking problems that are chronic, ongoing, bad enough to affect independence and daily life activities and don't seem to be due to something else. Alzheimer's is the most common underlying cause of that kind of progressive brain change, but there are other causes as well. And so cholinesterase inhibitors have often been used for other forms of dementia. That's in part because in real-world conditions, it can be often difficult to tease out which type of underlying dementia it is. And what has been observed is that it seems that often when people have Lewy body dementia or Parkinson's dementia, many of those people also seem to have lower than usual acetylcholine levels in the brain. And so cholinesterase inhibitors in some of them do seem to help. Cholinesterase inhibitors are also often used for vascular dementia. But again, keep in mind that in most people over age 80, what's most common is mixed dementia, and the most common mix is Alzheimer's and vascular. Memantine is often used in other types of dementia as well, but again, occasionally seems to increase agitation and hallucinations in some people with dementia. And so if you try that medication or your loved one tries it and that seems to happen, it might mean that this is not a good medication for them. And again, the benefit is likely to be modest. Let's now talk about how long should people stay on these medications and when do they get stopped? So in principle, what has often been recommended as a best practice is that if the patient and provider together decide to try this medication, see if the person with dementia might be a responder to this medication, it's done in sort of a thoughtful way. You first kind of assess cognition before you start the medication, and then you reassess people at 3 months, at 6 months. We certainly want to follow along to make sure that the person isn't having difficult side effects from the medication, but we want to check at 3 and 6 months to see, well, does it seem to be helping? Does their memory or thinking seem to be better? Do they seem to be having an easier time doing things? Because if there's no improvement at all, it's reasonable to think, well, maybe this is one of the 30 to 50% of people who don't really seem to have much response, and you could consider stopping the medication at that time. In practice, this almost never happens. In practice, people are often very eager to try anything that might help, even a little bit. Prescribers really want to help them with that. And so often these medications are prescribed often quite early, sometimes even when people have mild cognitive impairment, and they don't get a ton of follow-up to really objectively try to determine whether it's making a difference. And they continue these medications for years and years, essentially indefinitely. Is this a bad thing? These medications are often reasonably well tolerated. And so it's not necessarily a bad thing as long as the person, you know, is tolerating the medication. Is it making a big difference? People are going to eventually decline whether or not they are on these medications, and it's important to know that. And then when should we stop? So it's true that if people live with dementia a long enough time, their brain will continue to decline, and eventually they'll reach a stage that we often refer to as advanced dementia or severe dementia. And there is a FAST scale for dementia that you can find online. I also have a page on Better Health While Aging that describes dementia stages. So FAST-7 is a stage where people have lost a lot of language. They're either saying, usually they're saying very little or just a few words, and they've lost the ability to walk. So they're either chair-bound or bed-bound. And eventually they will also start having difficulty recognizing even familiar faces. And as dementia progresses, they'll become sort of quieter, and, you know, eventually might reach a stage where they're very quiet, they may barely open their eyes, and they're being spoon-fed. So the consensus among experts is that especially once people have declined to the point where they're saying very little, not walking, and not interacting much or recognizing people much, it's really not clear that these medications help, and they could be stopped at that point. Now, it has been seen that for people who are a little earlier than that, some of them, when we stop medications, do seem to get worse. They might get more agitated or restless, more irritable, more confused. And if that happens, it's reasonable to restart the medication. But in part, one of the reasons why we might stop medications when people reach the later stage of advanced or severe dementia is because those are people who, in a way, have lost the ability to get agitated or very upset, actually. And so that's part of why it might be reasonable to stop the medication at that time. So given all this, let me now share with you my practical geriatrician's take on these medications for Alzheimer's and other dementias. Overall, these drugs might offer a small benefit. I think people are often disappointed to realize that they're probably not going to have as much effect as they were hoping or as we were hoping. Because using these medications is unlikely to help someone with the things that I often see really mattering to older adults and to their families. Things like, you know, will this medication allow them to continue to live home alone where they really want to be for the longer term, or, you know, enable them to keep driving or something like that? The effect is generally going to be pretty modest. I wish we had something that was effective in that way, but we probably don't, not yet, hopefully. Hopefully in the future, but not really. So it's important I would encourage people to be realistic about the likely effect of these medications. Because on the other hand, as I was saying, these drugs are generally well tolerated. They do seem to have a little bit more of an effect in some people. So I think it's totally reasonable to try these medications and see if they really seem to make a difference for you or your loved one, depending on which of you is watching these videos. You just want to keep in mind that the effect's generally modest, and also this isn't changing the underlying course of the illness, that people are going to continue to decline. They just might be able to function a little better than they would otherwise. So if you're trying to figure out if you are on this journey of Alzheimer's or another dementia, and you're trying to figure out, what do we do about these oral medications? If you have already been on these medications for a while, if you're not having difficult side effects, I think it's totally reasonable to continue indefinitely. Now, if you are concerned about the expense of the medications or the pill burden, there are sometimes some older adults with dementia who really don't want to take medications or are having a lot of difficulty taking medications regularly, especially if they live alone. It's reasonable to consider tapering off these medications. You can always restart it if the person's symptoms seem worse off medication. Now, if you are somebody who's on this journey and you have not yet been on these medications and you're considering starting them, you should know again, you know, they're FDA approved for mild to moderate dementia, cholinesterase inhibitors. Memantine is not FDA approved for that. It would be used off label. You can still try it, see if it makes a difference for you, but just something to keep in mind. And these are not FDA approved for mild cognitive impairment. But again, if you and your provider decide you want to try it, just something to keep in mind. But yeah, I would definitely consider asking questions if these are being, you know, suggested very, very early on. And then consider a thoughtful 6-month trial approach, meaning if you decide to try them, you know, ideally, you would work with your health provider to document cognitive symptoms before starting the medication. you'll start at a low dose and then increase the full dose. So we generally don't start people on the full dose right away. It is normal to start with a lower dose and kind of work them up over a certain period of time. Give yourself some time on the full dose. Monitor for side effects such as nausea, diarrhea, a slower heart rate, and then reassess those cognitive symptoms at 3 months and 6 months. And if the person seems a little better, great. But if you're really seeing no improvement or the person has, you know, continued to decline a lot, it's reasonable to ask, do you want to continue the medication or not? And I think either answer is okay to go with. I really do. So in closing, I just want to speak briefly to a few other types of treatment to be aware of if you are considering treatment for Alzheimer's or another type of dementia. So again, as I mentioned at the beginning, we are in a really interesting time right now when it comes to Alzheimer's treatment. As of a few years ago, the first one became FDA approved in 2021. We have had some newer anti-amyloid therapies to treat Alzheimer's. And right now we have two available, lecanemab, brand name Leqembi, and donanemab, brand name Kisunla. Now, these are trickier to get. So whereas the older oral medications can be prescribed by your primary care provider, by, you know, a neurologist or a variety of providers in the community, these newer medications are infusions. They're quite expensive. Medicare right now has some conditions for reimbursements. Generally, they're going to require proof of amyloid deposition. This means getting special scans that check for amyloid. They require infusions. Lecanemab, I think it's every 2 weeks. Donanemab, once a month. They're supposed to be provided by a sort of trained team that can provide adequate monitoring because these medications do have the potential for causing small bleeds in the brain, which can cause swelling. That's a side effect that was seen in the trials and has been seen under real-world conditions as well. And in trials so far, these do reduce amyloid in the brain, which has been very exciting. And they can improve cognition and they can slow the progression of the illness, but they don't stop or cure the disease. And if you want to learn more about their effect, I highly recommend the related video that I'm going to be posting, an interview with a specialist who has been using this in a memory center where we go into a little bit more depth. But basically, we're still learning about how much effect they have, but you know what has been seen is people on this drug still decline. They just don't decline as quickly as people off the drug. So not a cure, but having an effect. So that's very exciting though. So we're still learning more about the effect of these newer treatments, and there may be some other newer ones coming up as well, but something to know if you are interested in Alzheimer's treatment. And then I just want to make another point that I think is really important, which is medications. We are so fortunate to have medications. And I truly believe that right now they are really only a small part of the solutions when it comes to managing Alzheimer's and dementia. Most of what is going to affect the quality of life of a person with dementia, and I would say even how well their brain can work on a given day, will not be about medication. It will be about other things. It will be about the way we are providing care to their body and mind and spirit, and the way we are providing support. So if you are looking into Alzheimer's treatment, I really want to encourage you to learn about the many non-drug approaches that help optimize brain function and slow decline. They include, for many people, exercise or other movement therapies. They include providing strategic support, especially when it comes to early Alzheimer's, so that people can continue to participate in activities that bring them enjoyment and purpose. It's important also to minimize brain-slowing medications. A lot of them are out there. I have videos about them. If you're not careful, it can be very easy to be taking something that's actually further slowing down the brain. Supportive routines. People who have Alzheimer's and dementia do really well with routines and some structure, and also with regular social engagement. That's so, so important. I just can't emphasize it enough. And then communication and behavior management training for family caregivers, because often we are trying to help and support the person. And sometimes they understand why we are offering help and support, and other times they may not, or they may be struggling a little bit to accept the fact that their brain is changing and that they might need to do things a little bit differently. And when we provide training to family members of better ways to go about offering that support, that can reduce conflict and that can improve quality of life, and the reduced stress level can help people's brains work better as well. So with that, thank you so very much for watching. And if you found this video podcast helpful, if you're here on YouTube, please go ahead and subscribe, as it does help more people find the channel. And if you're someone, again, who is trying to figure out how to help an aging parent, I have a special interest in supporting people like you. So I've created a variety of helping older parents resources and trainings. And I also have a book, When Your Aging Parent Needs Help. So if you'd like to get more useful information on how to care for your aging parents, including the free trainings, please visit betterhealthwhileaging.net/helping-older-parents. And then last but not least, if you've been listening to the audio version of this episode on the podcast feed, please come and take a look at the video if you get a chance. You'll see my key points displayed on the screen. So thank you once again, and I look forward to seeing you all again on a future episode of the Better Health While Aging video podcast.